Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Local governments, the center of gravity in the response to pandemic flu, will be with you. The report is bleak. It says an avian flu pandemic would roll through the country, causing weeks of infection in each area as it goes. The report also notes that 85% of food, financial services, and medical care are privately run, and says those businesses are responsible for staying open, even with 40% of their workforce out sick. USA Today reporter Anita Manning has seen the report. Anita, give us an example of this federal-local split.
The U.S. has a stockpile of vaccines and antivirals, but they also are asking state and local governments to have some antivirals on hand. And also the state and local governments will have to come up with their own plans for distributing it. The federal government says that they will provide plenty of guidance to the local health departments, but it's up to these local health departments, many of which are very stressed already and understaffed, to come up with the local plan.
I was going to say, there's been budget cuts, and many local communities hardly have a health department. Well, this report comes in the wake of the failed federal government response to Hurricane Katrina, and maybe the White House is recognizing its limitations, but what's been the response?
There's some concern that it's still a kind of mile-high view of things. It's still pretty broad. What it does is outline the responsibilities of the various departments of government. You know, the Health and Human Services will be the lead agency for medical issues. Homeland Security is responsible for coordinating non-medical responses. USDA is in charge of animal health issues. I think that what they're trying to do is to allow each department to develop its own detailed plan.
Well, we know that you spoke to public health advocacy groups who really worry about this community on its own kind of approach.
Money is going to them, but not very quickly, and not, according to the health departments, not enough. It has to be sustained so that local health departments can hire the personnel that they need to be able to manage a pandemic or some other kind of medical emergency.
Well, and the federal government in this report also talks about broader aspects of stopping the flu pandemic, or at least reacting to it, perhaps closing borders or isolating people who are on airplanes, but those also have issues.
You can transmit the flu a day to a day and a half before you even know you have it. So the idea of closing borders, it's just not effective. The same with air travel. How are you going to know if somebody has a little cough? Does that mean that everybody gets quarantined if somebody sneezes?
Well, this is phase two of White House preparations for a flu pandemic. Phase one, the strategic plan, was released in November. Just before we let you go, is there going to be someone at the federal level in this plan in charge of making sure that local communities and vital businesses are heeding the warning?
HHS Secretary Leavitt has been going out to the states and intends to visit every state to attend flu pandemic preparedness summits. So he is assuring that states have plans in place. But again, this will have to filter down.
And we read that there are some details in there about what workers should do, including staying 3 feet away from each other?
These are suggestions, yeah, that businesses might consider in their planning. They might consider, and they might be advised to have hand hygiene stuff on, you know, at on hand, those alcohol gels, you know, that kind of thing. They might be advised to encourage or restrict handshaking or face-to-face meetings. They might do more teleconferencing.
Anita Manning, she's a reporter for USA Today. She details today's White House report on flu pandemic in today's column. Anita, thanks so much.
Thank you.
A new history of the Mau Mau Rebellion in colonial Kenya in the 50s has just won the Pulitzer Prize. The British claimed the Kikuyu, the people behind the uprising, were barbarians who needed civilizing. But author Caroline Elkin's book, Imperial Reckoning, The Untold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya, documents stories of atrocities against the Kikuyu at the hands of the British. News of her Pulitzer spread quickly.
what was amazing is that the moment I hung up from my editor, who was the person who delivered the news, the phones just lit up, and many of those phone calls were coming from places in Kenya where people, both in Nairobi and from the furthest reaches up into the upcountry areas where I did my research, had heard the news, and they were simply ecstatic, and they have asked so often of me absolutely nothing other than that the world knows what happened to them. And I think for them, this was a true moment of triumph, and they truly believe now that the world can no longer forget their stories, and I think they're absolutely right.
Author Caroline Elkins today. When we spoke to Caroline last year, she told us that as a Harvard student 10 years earlier, she'd moved to Kenya, learned Swahili and Kikuyu, and traveled deep into Kikuyu land. And what she found completely changed her own preconceived notions of the Mau Mau insurgency.
Initially, I thought this was going to be a book about Britain's civilizing success. You know, I took a 180-degree turn, and 10 years of research led me to write a book about what I call Britain's gulag, the systematized torture and murder of 1.5 million Africans in Kenya.
You write that there was a murderous campaign to eliminate Kikuyu people that left tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands dead, and the British covered it up.
Yes, it's amazing. You know, at the eve of decolonization in 63, the British burned the vast majority of the files. Now, we know that the British are meticulous record keepers. So when you start going through, and this is what sort of started sending up the red flag for me, when things are missing in gross numbers, and suddenly you realize that entire departments of files are missing. And so, therefore, I started slowly to realize that my story began to change.
Well, this is quite an accusation. So let's take us through the process, how you came to that conclusion. Start with your initial perception of what the British role was in Kenya, what many people thought. And why was Britain there in the first place?
Well, they showed up in the first place because they, in fact, it was part of the scramble for Africa. And they were carved up the continent with the rest of Europe. And part of their peace was East Africa and Kenya. And, of course, they have to make these places pay. They're not going to be a burden on the British taxpayers. And so, therefore, at the end of the day, they decided to bring settlers there, and settlers were going to be the backbone of the political economy.
And the settlers displaced?
Yes, they displaced thousands and thousands of Africans. And what you do when you need to settle Europeans on African land is you simply take the land. And in this case, they took the land. Some of it came from the Kikuyu people, and they were terribly aggrieved. And from moment one, they complained bitterly about the loss of stolen land.
Who were the Kikuyu?
They were a group of Africans who live in the central part of Kenya. And what's important about the Kikuyu is they really are the group most impacted by European settlement because they live so closely to the European estates. So not only do they lose their land, but they become the chief labor source. And they are forced into the labor economy through taxation as well as coerced and forced labor.
And now the seed for their uprising, called the Mau Mau, was planted in a political group in the 20s called the KCA, Kikuyu Central Association. It was led by a young man named Johnstone Kenyatta. Boy, when I first came across that name in your book, it's been a long time since I've heard that name. Who was he?
Yes, I mean, Kenyatta is thought to be, by the British, the leader of darkness and death, they call him. And he's supposed to be the mastermind of Mau Mau. But what's curious about Kenyatta is he's actually a pretty conservative guy. He comes from a missionary-educated background, and he actually doesn't want to be a revolutionary. He just wants a piece of the action. But at the end of the day, it's seen that this grassroots movement that becomes Mau Mau, that the Africans themselves couldn't be capable of doing this. So they think that it's somebody like Kenyatta leading it, and in fact, it's not. But of course, Mau Mau comes along, they round everybody up, and Kenyatta gets detained along with everyone else.
And what was the spark that lit the Mau Mau uprising?
Well, I think really, Robin, when you look at the history of Africa, and Kenya's not an exception, many Africans fought in World War II on the front for the Allied forces, and they come back and expect life to be better.
And wait, they were Africans that were plucked out of
Africa and sent to Burma, North Africa, and they're there fighting on the front. And they come back and they're infused with this notion of self-determination, particularly from Asia, and they think that life is going to improve for them. And in fact, they get back and not only is it not improving, but it's getting worse.
And the settlers have taken their land.
The settlers have continued to take their land, and the settlers have profited from the economic boom of World War II. So things are getting worse and worse, and frankly, the Africans are irritated, and they at this point have gone from just petitioning the government to actually demanding a revolution.
And it goes from there to attacks, and the attacks by the Mau Mau were brutal.
Oh, they're awful. You know, and I think that this notion, as you mentioned, Mau Mau conjures the most horrible, bestial, savage images. And, you know, they were killing people with pangas or machetes. They had no access, really, to weapons. And you can imagine, hacking somebody to death is a terribly gruesome affair. But you have to bear in mind, though, Robin, that at the end of the day, only 32 settlers died in all of this. And when we think about the notion of proportionality, that's when one really begins to understand the draconian response on the part of the British colonial government.
Because, as you write, and it was well known at the time that Britain did launch an attack against 20,000 Mau Mau guerrillas with 20,000 British soldiers. And they also rounded up over a million more Kikuyu sympathizers to Mau Mau.
Mm-hmm.
And that's well known that they fought the Mau Mau. But what you discovered is that what they said was a civilizing detention hardly sounds like it.
Yes, not at all. You know, what they do, of course, this is 1950s, right? Mm. So we're talking post-World War II and international conventions. They're violating all sorts of human rights accords. So they have to get around this. And the way they get around this is they say that, listen, these Mau Mau aren't legitimate. They're the horrible, savage, awful people. And they say that, listen, okay, so we're rounding these people up in detention and detaining them, but we're rehabilitating them. We're turning them into good, Christian, middle-class citizens behind the barbed wire of detention. And they have this wonderful propaganda campaign, and they do a very effective job at it. Now, if you go to the Public Record Office, the official archive in London, there are files and files just about this, rehabilitation. So somebody like me comes along doing research on this, and no one had done any work on these detention camps before. You're very much seduced by what's in these records. But what you come to realize, and as we mentioned earlier, that in fact the reason why we see these records is because in part most of the other ones have been destroyed. So not only was there document destruction, but there's actually deliberate document destruction of things that didn't make them look so good, like the terror and the torture and the murder. Whereas the things that made the British colonial government look good or legitimize what they're up to, those were left intact.
And now we come to your personal part of the story, how you learned the language, got a car, drove into Kikuyu land, and got people to tell you their stories. We want to hear those stories, but what were you thinking? I mean, what did they think of you?
Yes. I mean, I think many of them didn't know quite what to make of me. And, you know, it took a lot of time. I spent a lot of time tending cows and playing with grandchildren and, you know, drawing water. And frankly, at the end of the day, many of them, after a couple of weeks of this, couldn't quite figure out what it was I was up to other than what it, you know, what I was purporting to be. And I was there with my research assistant, and they wanted to know why she wasn't married and why I, who was married, wasn't at home having children with my husband. But then we earned their trust.
Caroline Elkins, author of Imperial Reckoning, The Untold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya, which just won the Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction. Well, when we come back, more of what the Kikuyu told Caroline and the controversy her book has created in England, you can only imagine. Quick reminder, also coming up today, the real cost of the war in Iraq, starting with it costs about $134,000 per soldier per year to have a soldier in Iraq. That's still coming on the program, and more with Caroline Elkins when we come back. Stay with us here and now. Imperial Reckoning, The Untold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya, which just won the Pulitzer Prize. In hundreds of hours of testimony, Kenyans told Caroline the story of how the British systematically detained and, in many cases, tortured 1.5 million Africans in Kenya in the wake of the Mau Mau uprising. Now, we want to caution these stories can be gruesome, sometimes very hard to listen to. Here's Caroline Elkins again.
Some of it in your wildest nightmares, you couldn't imagine the kinds of torture that people were perpetrating against these Mau Mau adherents. For example, there was one case where a man who lives in Moringa District was talking to me what he saw across the barbed wire in Manyani camp. And he tells me this long story about how a man was brought in and he was turned upside down and his head put into a bucket of firewater. And then the European in charge of the camp ordered that the askaris, or the African guards, start putting sand and water back and forth, alternating into this man's anus as he's upside down in the water, and they're alternating and then cramming it in with a stick back and forth until, of course, suddenly the man collapses and he's carried off, and they start off with the next detainee. And these kinds of unimaginable tortures, and what I found so startling was the way in which these men and women would tell these stories, because they hadn't talked about this in years and years, but the vivid nature in which they recalled this was really very, very striking. And then, of course, listening to women talking about deciding which children would survive. They only had a limited number amount of food because there was a scorched earth policy. Women who would give themselves up to be raped to save their daughters. These kinds of horrific moral choices that people had to make on a daily basis.
What do the British say to these charges?
Two things are going on, Robin. Number one, there is a reparations case that in part is a result of this book, and there has been no response to that yet at all. But what is also going on in parallel, and this has just been recently while I was in Nairobi, and that is the Kenyan government for the first time has called upon the British to make an official apology. And the Foreign and Commonwealth Office recently responded quite briefly, stating that atrocities were committed on both sides of this war, and that Kenya should be looking toward the future and not dwelling upon the past. And I think that's the first response of probably what's going to be a series of them. But what is important is that the British, this is the first time the British have acknowledged that any atrocity was committed. And I think that they still have a lot to answer for, not the least of which was, why did they destroy all these documents on the eve of decolonization in 1963? And then why do they still leave classified dozens and dozens of very incriminating documents in their own public record office in London?
These men that you are writing about in the book, the British soldiers, are war heroes.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, I am not well received by many crowds, as you can imagine, in Britain. And absolutely. I mean, Mau Mau is the most horrific, horrible thing that ever happened, as far as many British are concerned.
To them.
To them. And that their soldiers were heroes and that they saved Kenya for humanity. And that any of these claims are made up, and that the Kikuyu are making up their stories. Now, the problem with this, Robin, is that even in this book, if you were to take out all of these oral testimonies and say, okay, we don't believe them, the problem is you've got to explain all the other evidence. And what's left behind, all good purges leave something behind. And what's left behind in the official archives, what's left behind in newspaper reports, what's left behind in memoirs, missionary documents, private archives, it's a mountain of evidence. And you've got to explain that away. Mm. And you also have to explain, once again, why did the British burn all the files?
And as you point out, in a funny way, the Kenyans became complicit in this because when British rule ended, Kenyatta came out of exile. He was elected Kenya's first president. He did a BBC interview, as you write, and the world suddenly saw there's this educated man with no horns, you know, the one who's supposed to be behind this horrific movement. But his ascent to president was bittersweet because he told the Kenyans, you have to forget the past.
Yes.
So,
yes.
So why didn't they raise these issues then in the early 60s?
Yes. I mean, I think that's a very good question. Two things. Number one, it was not just the British who were complicit in this, although they were directing much of the operation, but there were Kikuyu loyalists, people fighting, Africans fighting on the side of the British in return for being rewarded quite handsomely. And Kenyatta recognizes, and quite rightfully, that there could potentially be a huge civil backlash within his own independent country. Number two, this is largely a Kikuyu-only movement. Now, if Mau Mau accelerated independence, which in fact it did, how does everybody else share in the fruits of independence if they didn't fight for independence? Mm. So what happens is he comes in and says, forgive and forget, everybody's not to speak about the past, and then he says, we all fought for freedom. Mm. If the president is telling you this, and the British are destroying all the files, and of course, Kenyatta becomes the darling of the West during the Cold War, well, if you're some rural man or woman living in Central Province, you don't have a whole lot of power in trying to resurrect or lift this silencing. And so therefore it lasts for nearly 50 years until just recently.
Interesting, too. I just can't help but notice we're talking about detainees.
Yes.
Abuses.
Absolutely.
It's resonating, I'm sure, for you today.
Yes, absolutely, Robin. And, you know, I think one thing that we also have to bear in mind in this, which is very disturbing, and that is within the Bush administration today, they're influenced by people like John Archia, who has written reports in the San Francisco Chronicle about low-intensity operations. And that was the code name for British counterinsurgency. And people like Archia look to Kenya as the model for success. And he's passing this off to the Bush administration, who actually right now is adopting the British model that was used in places just like Kenya, just like what I describe in this book, as a success, that this is the way you deal with insurgents. This is the way you deal and have a low impact on local populations. Well, in part, Archia is not so far off in the sense that it used to be believed that, yes, this was successful. But I think that we better take a very quick reevaluation about Britain's past before we start implementing it in today in America's present, as well as the future in places like the Middle East and Afghanistan.
Harvard scholar Caroline Elkins, who just won the Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction for her book, Imperial Reckoning, The Untold Story of Britain's Gulag in Kenya. Caroline is now working with the Kenya National Museum to set up a permanent exhibit detailing British atrocities in Kenya that's set to open in June of 2007. Well, this note, tomorrow on Here and Now, a new voice in the gas wars, someone who says, hey, you pay more for your coffee than your gas, at least per cup, quit your complaining. We'll talk with an analyst who says the era of cheap oil is over. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program is produced.
That of reconstructing Iraq. For instance, we've learned that a $186 million project to build more than 100 health clinics in Iraq has produced only six so far. But little has been written about the cost of the entire war. Today, the Senate is expected to pass an emergency spending bill that would allocate $71 billion this year to pay for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And the research arm of Congress, the Congressional Research Service, has just released a report to assist lawmakers. It says the military burns through $2 billion a week in Iraq and that it now costs approximately $361,000 a year to put each American soldier there. Well, joining us on the line from Washington is the report's author. Amy Belasco is a defense specialist at the Congressional Research Service. And Amy, you have been working with a lot of zeros.
Yes.
Can you tell us, how did you arrive at that last astonishing number, $361,000 per year per every soldier in Iraq? Can you break that number down for us?
That's based on Defense Department reporting. And a rough sense of what that's for is if you look at 2005, about 15% of that total is for military personnel, which means special pays for being in combat, for feeding troops, and for activating reservists. And about 60% of our operating costs of one kind or another, both operating, going out on operations and fixing equipment and base support, you know, housing troops. And another quarter of it is for investment costs, which is replacing or upgrading equipment that's being used in the war.
Well, we're going to touch more on that in just a second. And now that you said that that figure includes pay, there are a lot of people who are going to be saying, you know, that's, you know, $361,000 isn't enough, you know, for the soldiers who go fight in Iraq. But let me tick through some more of your big picture numbers. If Congress, the Pentagon, and the President get everything they're asking for, the global war on terror so far will have cost $439 billion. That includes Afghanistan at $89 billion, Iraq at $320 billion, and domestic security at $26 billion. Of that $439 billion, $368 billion have been approved. What do these figures include? Is it just military spending?
No. These numbers also include monies for foreign operations and foreign aid costs, including reconstruction in Iraq and the cost of embassies in Iraq, very expensive embassy there, and in Afghanistan. It's 91% for the military operations piece, 9% for reconstruction embassy costs and all the various foreign aid programs, and less than 1% for medical care for veterans.
Is there a comparison here, for instance, to the Vietnam War?
Well, basically, if you look at all of the pieces, Iraq and the global war on terror would be about $466 billion if you put everything in 2007 dollars.
And Vietnam, in the same kind of dollars, is $650 billion.
And Vietnam was a conflict that lasted from, what, 65
12
to
years,
12 years?
Compared to 5 years.
And what are some of the reasons for that?
Well, there are a lot of reasons for that. One of the reasons is that we're spending a lot of money on new equipment, mm-hmm. which we would much less in Vietnam. People are more expensive than they were in Vietnam because when you draft someone, you don't need to pay them as much for special pays. And also we're using reservists, which is more expensive.
Oh.
It's a very different military in lots of different ways.
Yeah. You have some criticisms of the Department of Defense in your report, including that the Defense Department has not provided Congress with many of the costs of the wars. What are some of those?
Well, what they like to do and what they have done mostly is they'll give you what they call a monthly burn rate, which is the amount that they've spent, that they're spending every month for basically the people side and the operations side. You know, that's a kind of a convenient number, and a lot of people like that number because then you can say, oh, well, you know, it's $8.1 billion per month. But that really doesn't give you a complete sense of the cost, and it's just kind of a picture of a snapshot in time.
Well, and you also write that the accounting methods of the Department of Defense seem to be problematic, that there's money, billions of dollars, that just can't be tracked.
There's kind of a seven odd billion that it's not clear whether it got spent for global war on terror or not, and they tend to understate the costs. Mm. The Pentagon is always replacing and upgrading its equipment. So one of the big unanswered questions, I think, which would be useful for Congress to grapple with, is if you looked at all of these requirements together, would there be ways that you could reduce DOD's regular budget because they may be getting some of the monies to upgrade their equipment in supplemental budgets already? And I think that's a significant oversight issue for Congress.
In fact, you have other questions about oversight and about Congress. You ask several questions in your report, having done this report and this research. Share some of those with us.
Well, one of the ones is what types of war costs might be more controllable than others? We tend to assume that all war costs are essentially uncontrollable. Whatever the commanding officer wants or says he needs, he gets. But in fact, if you look at the figures, there's been a lot of variation in sort of mundane things like how much it costs to feed troops and house troops, and those numbers have gone up and down, and that raises the question of could you in fact control these costs by the types of contracts you have? If you had tighter contracts, might these kinds of things cost less? So, I mean, I think that's a significant oversight question. Another one is to actually get some consistent information about troop levels because, again, this is a case where the Pentagon witnesses generally report only those troops in country, in Iraq, who are about 140,000, and then in Afghanistan, somewhere around 20,000. And they leave out all of the additional people who are in the region, and that's closer to 300,000.
Amy, just, you know, we said it at the top, but hearing these numbers again, I mean, do you find these numbers astonishing? Or, and again, as you work with so many zeros and as you watch the numbers balloon, or is this just the business of going to war?
That's a difficult question. I think what's disturbing is that for these numbers on the cost of war, the trends are up for all of them, and the reasons why they're up are not terribly clear. And, you know, then it raises the larger question of what are we in for? You know, this year the war costs are close to $120 billion. You know, does this mean we're in for $100 billion more to the Pentagon's $440 billion regular budget? And if so, for how many years? So it's only partly the numbers themselves. It's the direction of the numbers. And yes, why is it quite so much? Why does it cost $40,000 to house per troop per year in Iraq? I mean, why is it that expensive? I really don't understand.
Amy Belasco, National Defense Specialist at the Congressional Research Service, which is the research arm of Congress. For a link to her report, go to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. When residents of 24 communities in Wisconsin approved ballot measures last month to bring the troops home from Iraq, a city councilwoman in Philadelphia was taking note, and she decided to bring up a similar measure in the city of Brotherly Love. If her referendum to bring troops home makes it onto the ballot and passes in November, Philadelphia would most likely become the nation's largest city to actually go on record on the war. Jenny Blackwell represents the 3rd District in Philadelphia. She joins us on the line. And Councilwoman Blackwell, we want to be clear. We know that around 70 communities around the country, including Philadelphia, passed resolutions about the war in Iraq. You're talking about a referendum. The resolutions were passed by what, the city councils?
Yes, and we also called for a referendum, so it would go on the ballot as well.
Well, understandably, that means that people will get to vote. But since you do represent the people, why wasn't the resolution enough?
Because we wanted to send a strong message to the president, as strong a message as we could send. And certainly we believe that sending a message that the voters have said this is what we should do, it takes it just a step further and gives him an official notice even among more people than just our body. Well, although we're elected to represent them, it sends a stronger message.
Well, Councilwoman Blackwell, some people would say that's what voting is about. You know that the voters also voted President Bush into office.
Oh, absolutely, and I totally agree. We're not trying to tell people how to vote. We're only saying that we believe this is an issue that affects every household, mm-hmm. that affects every neighborhood, and we want it to be not even a message just from its leaders, but a message from all people who vote so that he knows that the citizenry of this country have spoken out.
And, of course, you're also facing the possibility that they may vote down your referendum.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Well, the Philadelphia Inquirer pointed out that the money spent in Iraq could fund Pennsylvania for a decade. That's one issue. What are the other issues for you?
Oh, the issues are that parents are proud that their youngsters have gone. Residents feel glad about the young men and women from their communities who have served. But we think we've done our part and it's time to come home. We're proud of them. We support them. This is in no way a criticism of the president, what has happened in the past. What it is that it's a notice saying we've done our part. Now we want our folks home.
Are you hearing from any constituents who say, well, wait a minute, I have a child in Iraq, and I see this referendum as a vote of non-support for them?
I'm hearing grandparents and parents who get up and cheer me in public meetings who say, I'm afraid for my family member, I'm afraid for my loved one. That's what I'm getting more than anything.
What do you say to people who say, you're a Democrat and this is just a political move?
Well, I think that I'm proud to be a Democrat. However, I tried to word it carefully so that I didn't offend my Republican colleagues. It really is a human rights issue for me, and we tried to make it that. I'm glad if more people come out to vote, there's no partisan appeal, no intent at all in this legislation.
Councilwoman Blackwell, do you have the referendum there, and can you read it to us?
Okay. Proposing an amendment to Article 8, Chapter 5 of the Philadelphia Home Rule Charter entitled Referenda Approved by the Voters by adding a new section providing that the citizens of Philadelphia urge the United States to begin immediate withdrawal of its troops from Iraq, beginning with the National Guard and Reserve and ending with the total withdrawal of U.S. troops by the end of year 2006.
That's Councilwoman Jenny Blackwell of Philadelphia. She's proposing that referendum question be put before the voters in November. A long process to go through before, to see if it even gets on the ballot. But Councilwoman Blackwell, thanks for speaking to us about it.
Thank you.
And here's a quick update on two stories we've been following. Senator Arlen Specter is promising to hold hearings about the president's use of signing statements to bypass more than 750 laws. Charlie Savage, the Boston Globe reporter who broke that story, told us the president has the power to use the signing statements and has been using them instead of the more public vetoes. And in another story, publisher Little Brown & Company is now saying it has canceled a two-book deal with Harvard student author Kaiva Viswanathan after finding more examples of plagiarism in her debut novel. Stay with us. More ahead here and now.
are ended.
Our revels now are ended.
These are actors.
These are actors.
As I foretold you.
Actors preparing a scene for an upcoming performance of Shakespeare's The Tempest. The difference between this and other rehearsals? Well, this one's taking place at the Luther Luckett Correctional Complex in LaGrange, Kentucky. For the past 11 years, director Kurt Toftlin has been coming to the prison as part of the Kentucky Shakespeare Festival's program, Shakespeare Behind Bars. Well, now a new film documents Kurt's work with inmates. It's also called Shakespeare Behind Bars. And joining us from WFPL in Louisville is Kurt Toftlin. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And we're also joined by Jerry Gunthener, who plays Caliban in the production of The Tempest. He's still in Luther Luckett, and we want to make sure people know, Jerry, that you had to get permission from the facility to talk to us.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
And thank you. We understand this is a privilege that you are enjoying, and we thank the prison for allowing you to do it. I want to turn to Kurt first. You say in the film that Shakespeare would be very pleased with the people who are, you know, the actors who are in this production. Why?
Well, deep, deep passion for the spoken word, deep passion for storytelling, deep passion for transformation, for exploring humanity, the quintessence of dust, as Hamlet says. I think you'd be very honored.
Well, also, you say that people back in Shakespeare's day who were in the theater were the pickpockets, the thieves, the murderers.
Well, I'm not sure if they were those specific type of criminals, but they were thought of as those criminals. And a company, when it toured, had to travel under the auspices of a nobleman's name, the king's men, the queen's players, because they were thought of as a bit of the riffraff that traveled the countryside. You didn't want your daughter running away with an actor.
And Jerry, and you said I can call you Big G,
yeah.
Which is the name you go by in the film. You are, and your fellow actors are those people. The thieves, the murderers. May I ask, what landed you in prison?
I killed an undercover police officer in 1986.
What is this opportunity to be in a Shakespearean play? What does this do for you? Why did it appeal to you?
Well, at first, I joined Shakespeare because I saw a bunch of guys having fun. Then I didn't realize what I was getting myself into, the chance to search my own soul, to find the truth of a character, find it in myself, find what led me to prison and to do everything I can to not make the mistakes that landed me here.
Right. There's a scene in the film where you talk about the misconceptions you had about prisoners and acting. Let's listen.
I've often thought that a bunch of convicts would make good actors because they're used to lying or you know, playing a role. But it's the exact opposite of that, because it's to tell the truth and to inhabit a character. But for every trifle are they set upon me.
Jerry Gunthener is speaking there in the film Shakespeare Behind Bars and rehearsing the role of Caliban. Kurt, just remind us briefly of this particular play. This is The Tempest, when a great storm hits a ship carrying the King of Naples. People are abandoned on an island. Tell us a little more about it.
It's a play about revenge, and it's a play about forgiveness. Prospero creates a storm which lands all of his enemies on his island, and he is a very powerful magician. He could smash them, but he's going to torture them for a while. He's going to take delight in his revenge. But in the end, he discovers forgiveness.
Well, in fact, the actor playing Prospero, we find out that he actually electrocuted his wife. Another actor strangles his girlfriend, and, you know, he talks about forgiving himself finally after so many years. And we see scenes where you are trying to pull anger out of him in one of his performances, and we think, well, maybe it's, you know, maybe it's scary for him to go near anger, since through his anger he murdered someone.
If we...
Nah, you don't own that.
If we are marked to die...
Yes!
We are now to do our country laws.
Yeah.
And if to live...
What?
The few men a greater share of honor.
The what?
God's peace.
The what?
I would
not... The greater what?
The greater share of honor.
What is it that you want us to do? To be what?
Share the honor.
Honor.
But it's very complicated for a viewer of this film because you feel uncomfortable feeling sympathy for someone who's a murderer. What do you say to people who are wondering, well, gee, I'm not sure if I support these guys having a process of forgiveness or a process of redemption?
Well, what I would say is that 97% of us are coming back out to the world. And so do you want us to come back in the same state that we entered prison, or do you want us to get the help that we need figure out why we made the mistakes that led us to our heinous crimes, and to work on ourselves as people so that when we do return, we'll be able to be productive members of society once again.
Kurt, many of these men, because of their sentences, their lengthy sentences, are in the group year after year. Do you see that happening? Do you see them changing?
We have, in 11 years, put 30 guys on the street. Of those 30 guys, there is no recidivism for committing a new crime.
That's extraordinary relative to other recidivism rates.
Absolutely. And it is this process, this journey. People have asked me, why don't you deal with the victims? My response is, I would deal with the victims, but they're not all in one place. The perpetrators are in one place, and there's victimization within the perpetration. It may be people that have been victimized would disagree with me, but what I feel is that it honors the victim if the perpetrator takes responsibility for his or her actions and grieves for what it is that they did and feels empathy. And I do see them change. And I can tell you that I, having worked with them for 11 years, have changed also. I think I'm more humane. I think I'm a deeper human being. And I also believe in the higher powers of forgiveness, mercy, and redemption, and justice. This is not an easy program for guys to get into. They are pushed in the direction of fully accepting responsibility for what they did, fully honoring it and owning it. And that's a very, very long, difficult process.
Jerry Gunthiner, as you said, you killed a man, an undercover cop, years ago. And maybe this is too easy a way of looking at it, but was there a moment through Shakespeare, you know, was there some character that helped you unlock some realizations about what you did?
I think a perfect example of one of my epiphanies would be in the role as Caliban in The Tempest. Caliban come to prison, not taking responsibility for his actions, hating police officers, hating the guards, and by the end of the play, you know, he's vowed to seek for grace and be wise thereafter. And I think that's what we're all trying to do in Shakespeare, is take responsibility for what we've done and somehow, whatever way we can, make amends for it.
Well, how does this resonate with other guys in the prison? I mean, here you are, you all just seem, you know, so into it, and you're wandering around discussing lines like, we are such stuff as dreams are made of. And I'm just imagining that, you know, in most prison settings, that wouldn't go over very well. How does the rest of the population react to you guys?
They're very positive about it. I think that's one of the reasons why Kurt works with us year in and year out. Some of us older guys that may not ever get out, and if we do get out, it'll be a long while. The things that we learn, we take out onto the yard, and we share with the other guys on the yard, and they see that we're being positive, and they see the rewards, and they see us change as people, just like the officers here do, and they respect that.
Thanks for speaking with us.
You're quite welcome. It's been my pleasure.
Kurt, thank you as well.
Thank you, Robin.
Director Kurt Tofteland and inmate and actor Jerry Gunthiner, who again is appearing on this program as a privilege courtesy of the Luther Luckett Correctional Complex in LaGrange, Kentucky. Both also appear in the new documentary film Shakespeare Behind Bars, which is opening in theaters around the country this spring in Boston this Friday. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. And